need a quorum. Call to order the House Committee on Healthcare for this lovely February 18th. And open up a public hearing on House Bill 2136 and invite our esteemed colleague to join us for it before she has to run off and testify on a bunch of other bills. Anybody else can testify on this, please sign up.
Okay, is Tyler going to read the staff nurse summary?
You want to tell us what the bill's about?
I can. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2136 directs that monies received under the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement be distributed to Oregon Health Authority Fund and to the Tobacco Reduction Account, continuously appropriates monies deposited in the Oregon Health Authority Fund for healthcare initiatives, and applies to monies received by the state under the Master Tobacco Settlement Agreement after January 1st, 2014, and declares an emergency effective on its passage.
Excuse me. Mr. Chair, if I may.
Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm State Representative Carolyn Kinney. I represent House District 41, which is Milwaukee and Oak Grove and parts of Southeast Portland. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today about this very important topic, tobacco prevention. As I'm sure you know, tobacco use is the leading cause of preventable death and disease in this country. This addictive substance shortens lives and increases health care costs for us all. And surely the most cost-effective public policy is to invest in prevention and to avoid these damaging effects before they begin. 10 years ago, thanks to then Attorney General Hardy Myers and others, tobacco companies were forced to take responsibility for their years of deception and lies and pay billions of dollars to the states in compensation. At that time, when the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement dollars came to Oregon, the legislature found itself facing a recession. Funny thing. Revenue continued to drop, and regretfully, the decision was made to divert those Tobacco Master Settlement funds to other purposes. The Attorney General, as well as the overwhelming majority of Oregonians, expected to see the dollars used for prevention and children's health. Investments which would begin to ease tobacco's tremendous financial and social burden in our state. Indeed, over $1 billion from the tobacco industry has come into our state over these past 10 years, and not one penny has gone to tobacco prevention. Not one penny. 10 years later, today, we have an opportunity to lead the nation in creating healthier, active, tobacco-free communities by finally dedicating the settlement agreement funds toward their intended purpose. For too long, we've let preventable cost drivers like tobacco undermine the potential of our children, community, and our workforce. While the last 10 years have been a missed opportunity for the Tobacco Master Settlement Funds Agreement, this year's final debt service payment could not be better timed. Oregon is leading the nation in health transformation, and I am proud of the work we've done as a legislature to forge a new path. As our coordinated care organizations begin to do work differently, we can ensure their success by investing the settlement agreement dollars in innovative programs that target the root cause of chronic illness. We know that prevention is the key to long-term savings, but often the needs of today prevent us from changing course. This House Bill 2136 can be a game changer. The bill directs 10% of these tobacco industry dollars to work to prevent children from smoking and to help smokers quit. With this change, the tobacco agreement dollars will keep our children healthy and smoke-free, improve the lives of the people tobacco has made sick, and can be a catalyst for health transformation and create long-term savings in our health system. It's time to use tobacco industry dollars in targeted, proven, prevention investments that protect our children and our future. And I thank you. Mr. Chair, if I may, people will be coming after me that can probably answer all the questions that you have. I'm supposed to be in another committee presenting several bills. So if I may be excused, I will go to that committee.
I'm not coming back.
I won't come back. Thank you all. Thank you, Mr.
Very
Chair.
Very much. Let me just see if there's anybody that has a brief question of Representative Tomei. We do have other people testifying.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We have some other folks that are testifying. Let's take a technical testimony first from Fred Boss of DOJ. There's a little an amendment coming and a little issue that would need to be. Please introduce yourself and go for it.
Thank you, Chair Greenlich, members of the committee. My name is Fred Boss. I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division at the Oregon Department of Justice. I am here to urge you to amend House Bill 2136. As you know, House Bill 2136 directs disbursement of the funds received from the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement, 90% to the Health Authority and 10% to the Tobacco Use Reduction Account. The problem is that the bill eliminates the funding used by the Department of Justice to enforce Oregon's non-participating manufacturer statutes by eliminating a provision in ORS 293, which transfers funds from the Tobacco Settlement Funds account to the Tobacco Enforcement Fund account. The Master Settlement Agreement requires that Oregon diligently enforce its non-participating manufacturer statutes in order to avoid a potential downward adjustment of its yearly payments. The last biennium, the department received $1.2 million in order to have its to finance its enforcement efforts. If the state of Oregon is found not to be diligent in the enforcement of these particular statutes, the potential cost of to the state is between $150 to $180 million a biennium. So we have a proposed amendment, and we urge the committee to allow us to amend the bill.
Will you help us with the numbers? I think we're estimating $120 million for the total piece of the settlement to the state, $12 million of which is proposed to go to the Tobacco Use Reduction Fund, and you're talking about $1.2 billion roughly. So you're talking about 1% of the total amount of money. Do I have those right?
Chair Greenlich, I believe we receive between $75 and $90 million per year.
Per year.
And that it fluctuates. There are a whole series of adjustments. The one I'm talking about here is the NPM, non-participating manufacturer adjustment.
So
there are inflation adjustments.
Between $150 million biennium and upwards. Is that right?
That is correct. That's my estimation. And yes, it would be actually then less than 1%.
Yep. There. Questions?
To follow up on that, just for clarity, now we're taking funds that are freed up from the paying off of bonds and diverting them to tobacco. Now, and that's set at 10%. Is that 10% of $120 million or 10% of $150, $60, $70
million? It's 10% of whatever it is.
Isn't it going to be predicated on the amount of bonds we paid off, money freed up from bonds?
Yeah, but I mean, isn't 10% of 120 is 10% of whatever number that turns out to be?
Oh, okay, fine, yeah.
But the question is this a net? I mean, what I hear in your question, is this a net amount? There's some confusion among the committee as to whether this money is actually being used to pay off the 2002 special session nonsense. Have we got that all paid off?
Chair Greenlich, I can answer that. I'm here to testify solely about the DOJ portion. However, I've been around the block, and I was around in that time. And the those bonds are not directly related or linked to the MSA payments. So we did not do what many states did, called securitizing their payments. But I believe there was a general understanding that the payment of those bonds would come from the master settlement funds, but there is no direct link. I understand anecdotally that those bonds are coming to their to their end.
That's what I had heard, that yeah. The bonds we sort of dedicated this money to as have been paid off, so at least now conceptually we have this money to spend any way we want, although we could have spent it any way we wanted all along.
Chair Greenlee, correct. That's my understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for clarity also, so is we don't see the amendment yet. Is it that you would withhold whatever it is you need to do your enforcement on a reimbursement basis, and the rest would go to the 90-10 formula?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Geyer, yes. It'd be essentially reinstating that provision that had been deleted,
yeah.
And that is what happens. It comes in, and then...
You have that provision in front of you?
I have the bill, and it's in...
In the bill, it's the language on from page... from line 9 through...
22
through line 12, maybe, is that right? No. Yes.
Chair Greenlee, 19. It's on page 1, line 9 through 19.
Mm-hmm. But essentially, the amendment would
reinstate.
It would
reinstate those lines. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Chair Greenlee.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Widener.
Just real quick, and we may have other departments come up
you
here.
You always say real quick, but you don't really
mean real quick. I'd like to get an idea of what other departments might be affected by this, because to me the tobacco settlement money should be going for departments like yours and for treating people who have smoked and things like that. And I worry a little bit that sometimes we try to take the money and we use it for things that it wasn't intended to in the circumstance. I was just wondering if you know of any other departments besides yourself that this would affect this bill here the way it's drafted. Is there anybody else we need to look at?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Widener, this is not my area of expertise. I solely focus on the enforcement, but my recollection is that there are bonds, OHSU bonds, also being paid from these funds, and that's, I don't know whether those bonds have been satisfied or will be satisfied shortly.
Well, we may hear some testimony on that, find out if there is. And right now the money all goes into the general fund, is that right?
Chair Greenlee, I don't believe so. I think it goes it's like a cascading, it goes into one fund, and then eventually it does end up in the general fund.
Before we try and move on this, and the move would only be to the Ways and Means Committee at any rate, this has a subsequent the Ways and Means. So essentially we're going to be talking about the policy, should a certain amount be set aside specifically for the tobacco use reduction program. But Ways and Means will deal with these other things. But it would be useful for us to hear how this bill will change, other than that 10%, will change the distribution of funds. That would be important. So if there's anybody in the audience that can testify on that would be helpful. If not, we'll get it in a different hearing. Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Now we have two more people who have signed up so far. If there's anybody who can answer that question, we'd be happy to add you to the list. We have Alejandro Corral and Stephanie Thomas-Sweet. Stephanie, you know everything, right? You think that's funny, right?
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Alejandro Queral. I am a program officer with the Northwest Health Foundation.
You didn't miss that pronunciation by much. Right?
You did great, Representative Greenlake. Thank you, yes. some of you may know, the Northwest Health Foundation is an independent nonprofit foundation that seeks to advance, support, and promote the health of the people of Oregon and Southwest Washington. And we do this through a variety of means, including grant making, convening, and policy advocacy, among other things. As you have just heard from Representative Tomei, Oregon has been in a position of not being able to access the Master Settlement Agreement funds to spend on tobacco prevention initiatives for the past 10 years. I am here today to support the concept within House Bill 2136 of dedicating at least 10% of tobacco Master Settlement Agreement funds to tobacco prevention and education, and to urge this committee, frankly, to consider allocating additional Master Settlement Agreement dollars to further prevention and particularly of chronic disease. Under the Master Settlement Agreement signed in 1998, Oregon has received over $1 billion from tobacco companies. That's a lot of money that was originally intended to compensate for the states for past and future health care costs incurred as a result of tobacco use. But in 2003, the legislature chose to allocate the next 10 years' worth of MSA dollars to pay back general appropriation funds and to pay for tobacco enforcement fund. So while we've received over $1 billion in payments from tobacco companies, not one penny of that has gone to tobacco prevention. Let's put MSA dollars in context for a minute. In 2009, Oregon received $98 million from tobacco companies. That same year, tobacco cost Oregonians more than $1.2 billion in direct medical expenditures alone. So even if all of MSA dollars that Oregon receives each year were spent on tobacco prevention, cessation, and medical treatment, it would only cover about 7% of the $1 billion of direct healthcare costs incurred by Oregon taxpayers a year. Fortunately, our state has a tobacco prevention and education program that works. 4 years after Oregon voters approved Measure 44 in 1996, TPIP helped reduce per capita cigarette consumption by more than 20%. 10 years after inception, per capita cigarette consumption in Oregon had decreased by 50%. And further evidence that tobacco prevention education programs work is based on a recent California study or analysis of California's tobacco prevention program that in a period of 17 years, California spent $2.4 billion on tobacco control, but it saved over $134 billion in prevented chronic disease. So by dedicating 10% of Master Settlement Agreement dollars to tobacco prevention and education, the legislature would empower the program to do a lot more, to reach 4,200 youth under 18 in Oregon who become new daily smokers each year, and stop them from starting to smoke. Northwest Health Foundation supports the concept that tobacco Master Settlement Agreement dollars should be spent for what it was intended, tobacco control, tobacco prevention, and tobacco cessation. And today this concept is more important and relevant because Oregon's health system transformation has as its central goal to improve health, provide better care, and reduce costs of health care. Investing in prevention leads to better health and lesser costs. In other words, investing in tobacco Master Settlement Agreement dollars into tobacco prevention and other chronic disease prevention initiatives now would be an investment to ensure the success of a health system transformation in Oregon. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Do you know what percentage of your grants from the Northwest Health Foundation go to reducing tobacco use?
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, that's a great question. The Northwest Health Foundation has supported tobacco control through a variety of means, not only directly by supporting tobacco cessation programs or tobacco prevention initiatives in communities, but also through a variety of other means, policy advocacy around tobacco taxes, increasing tobacco taxes, about promoting and enforcing the Oregon Indoor Cleaner Act, and a variety of other means. I could not give you a specific percentage of what we've dedicated to tobacco control in recent years, but I can get back to you with that answer.
Mr. Chair. Nice answer. You have friends on the committee, as you know.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
You want to announce your conflict of interest as a board member?
Conflict of interest. I'm a board member of Northwest Health Foundation, and along with a former board member here.
I was a founding board member and served for 10 years on the foundation.
I appreciate your work
very much. Representative Kenneman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. How many active smokers do we currently estimate are in Oregon?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Kenemer, I'm going to ask my colleague, Stephanie Tamasweet from American Heart Association, who does happen to know a lot about the statistics on this.
Maybe I jumped the gun.
So I'm going to put her on
trying to help
for a second.
So
I don't know the answer off the top of my head.
Should I go ahead?
Introduce yourself.
Okay, thank you very much. My name is Stephanie.
We'll have the answer before we're done, if I have to give it to you myself.
I'm not sure about all that, but my name is Stephanie Tamasweet. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the American Heart Association. Thank you, Chair Greenlee, for having us here today and members of the committee. I'm madly, frantically writing lots of notes and questions, and it sounds like I'm going to have to come back up with myself and other smarter people to answer the many numerous questions that we have. I don't have to specifically address that right now. I don't have the number of active smokers. I know it's about 20%.
It's about 15% of the adults now for youth.
And about 15% of the adult population.
And about 30% of the adults in the Oregon Health Plan population.
So I can't do that math.
30,000.
Looking up in my head if somebody else.
30%.
About 30,000.
No.
Somewhere around 600,000. I'm just thinking about Medicaid being 15% of the population is 600,000.
Yeah, maybe 200,000 adults in 9%.
And the I can let you know just to prepare you for future data, that number actually did go up this year. There I have new statistics, and the reason for that is not necessarily because there are more smokers. It's because the new data mechanisms that they've used for testing include cell phone data. And so it's a little bit tricky because we're using that number, and it goes up from what it's been in the past when they were just using the home lines. But that's to prepare you for that higher percentage number. So they have new, more comprehensive means for getting in touch with people, and that's a good thing, but it's difficult for the data. So, okay, I'll go ahead and jump in. Our mission is to prevent, to build healthier lives free of cardiovascular disease and stroke, and tobacco prevention has been a top priority for our association since our existence, and then definitely over the last 4 years. And really what I'm here to talk about today is the health impact and the economic impact that of smoking and tobacco use on Oregon. Widely documented, tobacco use remains the number one cause of preventable death and disease in Oregon. Increasingly, we're seeing that it's not only a cause of death, but also a leading cause of disability, which is a huge concern when we look at its impact on stroke and the costs that we're paying associated for folks who have stroke and all the disabilities that are associated. Every year, tobacco use kills 7,000 Oregonians, and secondhand smoke causes an additional 800 deaths in Oregon. And using the current smoking data rates, or the smoking rates, 74,000 kids now under 18 and alive in Oregon will ultimately die prematurely from smoking. So smoking contributes to, as we all know and are sadly well familiar with, heart disease, heart attack, stroke, coronary heart disease, sudden cardiac arrest. An estimated 4.6 million Americans have congestive heart failure every year, and 43,000 die from it every year. And children are especially vulnerable to the health risks associated with smoking. Children with exposure to secondhand smoke are at an increased risk for sudden infant death syndrome, lower respiratory infections, severe asthma, respiratory problems, and the list can go on and on. We're very familiar with that. Alejandro spoke to this briefly, but Oregon spends more than $1 billion in direct medical costs for tobacco-related issues. This amount covers all payers, public and private, and according to the CDC, $347 million of that $1 billion is spent on the Oregon Health Plan, so directly to the Medicaid population, and the rest is paid out of private, out-of-pocket insurance. So Oregon does have a tobacco prevention program. We have made tremendous impacts, as you've already heard, with the funds that we have been given. It's funded about $15 million biennium. Since the program started in 1996, smoking has declined about 54% among 13 to 14-year-olds and 46% with 11th graders. And women are 34% less likely to expose themselves to cigarette smoke while pregnant, which is a huge win for us. It's something that we're nationally recognized for. One of the other things that we are most proud of is passing one of the most comprehensive smoke-free acts. And on January 1st of this year, Governor Kitzhaber issued a smoke-free campus policy as well, which is going to be rolling out over the next year and 2 years. So huge success that this Oregon legislative body has been a part of as far as protecting kids kids, making sure that we're preventing children from ever picking up that cigarette in the first place. If they do happen to get addicted to tobacco, making sure that we're helping them with the cessation benefits and the counseling efforts and impacts that they need. With that said, we have a long, long way to go. And we were looking at 20% of the population, adult population, still smoking, or youth population, and 15 of the adult population. We know we can do a lot better. And going back to Representative Tomei's comments at the beginning of this panel, not one penny of the Tobacco Master Settlement dollars, which we've been receiving year after year, have gone towards that tobacco prevention program. So I do have, sadly, maybe the one question that I can answer from the panel, is we have this little chart, and I can provide it to all the committee members. It shows the funds that we've been receiving since the settlement agreement. So it's over $1.4 billion. It breaks it up here. So the biggest is those debt service payments. I've been told they're called general appropriation bonds. I'm not an expert on that, but we can bring someone to you. My understanding is that those bonds have to be paid before getting to the other general fund payments. And then we have OHP debt service on OHSU, and then general fund, and the DOJ piece is in here as well. So I'll get you this chart as a follow-up. It shows you how the funds have been allocated. Most importantly, from my testimony, you can see there are no colors here that are specifically focused on tobacco prevention, and that's what we want to see here today. So we would love to invest some of these dollars as they were originally purposed towards the prevention program.
Are there any questions?
Actually, I do, Mr. Chair.
Quickly, right?
No, longly. Just real quick on the classifications, because you're talking about different people who are suffering, just kind of wanted to get an idea of how you categorize or classify who falls into the tobacco settlement, because you mentioned heart disease, things like that. There's lots of people who suffer from heart disease that have never smoked. How do you decide if they fall in, and if they, do you include everybody, or how is that calculated?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Weiner, the information that we get comes from, for the death, the statistics around people who die from heart disease, that's from the death certificates. So when the death certificates are filed, there is a cause of death on there, and they can attribute tobacco as a contributing factor towards the cause of death. And the other data we get from the Tobacco Prevention Education Program, and I can follow up with the specifics on how the diseases are tracked, the information that we do have is from the Public Health Department.
Question. Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember statistics from last year, and I'm not sure which it's attributed to, but if we get some federal funds for the TPEP program, but if we cross over a barrier of youth, it's either youth smoking, more than 20% of our youth smoking, or more than 20% of our youth being able to access tobacco underage, we lose some of these federal funds. And I forget which statistic that's attached to, but we bump up, and it looks, you know, we used to be 19%, and if it's attached to actually youth who smoke, we're already at 20%, and we could lose that federal funding. So I wonder if you could clarify that, but certainly that would make a huge argument for putting it, because we're one of the states, I think North Carolina is like 2%, even though it's a tobacco state, and we are one of the highest states, even though we've made some great gains because of policy, we actually have put so little money, and we want to make sure that we draw that number down, partly so we don't lose the federal funds, but partly, you know, it's way easier to get people to prevent them from starting to smoke than it is when they're adults and they're addicted, and it's much harder. So the question is, do you know which of that 20% is where we would lose the federal funding? Is it attached to the sting operations, or is it attached to the number of kids that smoke?
So Chair Greenlake and Representative Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, what you are referencing is the youth access rate, so mm-hmm. the ability for underage youth to be able to go into a plaid pant or into a convenience store and purchase tobacco if they are not carded. So, you know, how easy is it for an underage youth to be able to purchase tobacco? And so we are able to access federal funds to help us impact the youth access rate and the youth smoking rate, as long as our we do have to keep this certain level of rate of access rate down. So that specific funding stream is connected to the youth access rate. Mm-hmm. And so it's not to the entire smoking rate for the population. And I can speak to this a little bit and maybe follow up with some more information as well, but the last legislative session, we were able to address some of that in order to keep our rate down. And so that's a thank you to the legislature for doing that.
I'm going to close this public hearing. I am going to have another public hearing or a work session. Since nobody signed up in opposition, I assume there's no opposition to this. So as long as I don't hear from anybody that they're opposed to this bill, I'll assume it's fine to move it along two ways and means.
Mr. Chair.
Making it a perspective of the policy, not the money. Let them worry about the money.
If we could, I wouldn't mind actually bringing an amendment, because to me, all the tobacco settlement money should be going to tobacco cessation and taking care of people who have smoked. They're the ones who paid the, when they bought the cigarettes, paid for this, and it should be for treatment of people who are suffering from things from, so I would like to do an amendment to this bill if it's possible.
We'll certainly wait for it.
So, well, if you work it right now, I guess
I
have to take it.
No, I didn't say we would work it. I've just closed it.
Oh, I thought you were going to reopen it into a work session, and
no,
I was like,
I'm not, okay. No, I think, I have a suspicion that this is not without opposition. But since I haven't heard any testimony in opposition, then if we don't get any testimony in opposition, I'll assume there is no opposition to this, and we'll
I thought you were going to work it.
Move it along, but not right now.
Move it along to me meant something different. Yeah. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
The DOJ amendment.
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2136 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2181 and ask our colleague, Representative Boone, to join us. You have somebody with you.
I do.
His name I can't. Brian? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for hearing 2181. I have brought with me at the table a good friend and part-time constituent like you are, Mr. Chair, Jackie Bryant. And
unfortunately, very part-time.
Yeah. Well, she's more time full-time than you are. But this bill. Ms. Bryan came to me and told me about this, and I said that maybe we could do something about this with some legislation. We were happy to hear that we were getting a hearing, but subsequently, because of the speed with which this session is moving forward, we didn't have enough time to work out all the concerns of some of the concerned people. So I've brought with me a representative from one of the insurance companies, Elise Brown. And we have talked to a couple other people from other insurance companies. We do intend to go back after this meeting at some point in the next week or so and have a meeting.
I apologize. I forgot to ask our committee administrator to describe the bill for us.
He'll
take a shot at it, and you can expand on that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2181 requires an insurer offering health insurance to have adequate network of trauma system hospitals to ensure reasonable geographic access to in-network trauma system hospitals for each insured. Requires insurer to reimburse for services provided by out-of-network trauma system hospitals at a specified rate. Provides that healthcare providers must accept reimbursement as payment in full and may not bill insured for the balance. And specifies that a provider that institutes suit to collect balance must pay reasonable costs and attorney fees incurred by the patient to defend the action.
That's fine, and I failed to identify myself. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, the beautiful Upper Left Coast. And so anyway, I brought this, had this bill drafted at the request of my constituent. We both saw that there was a need for something to happen. We realized she's probably not the only patient to experience this situation, but some things have come up, and so I'm going to let her tell her story, and you have copies of her testimony and also copies of letters she received from her insurance company and one of the hospitals she was treated by. So,
thank you for bringing it to us.
Jackie Bryant. And basically my story is that I had an accidental fall down the stairs. and that my sister then took me to St. Vincent's Hospital, where that after hearing what had happened during the fall, the emergency room doctor decided that I need to have a head scan, which I did, and it turned out that I had a subdural hematoma, and so that I needed to be sent to a trauma hospital instead of apparently staying at St. Vincent's, where that my insurance covers in-network at St. Vincent's. So I was sent by ambulance in an induced coma to Emmanuel Hospital and underwent surgery, and I was told it was life-threatening. So they did, I had also broken my wrist, so they worked on my wrist as well as my head at the same time. And after a couple of days in ICU, I was taken to a room, and the assistant to the doctor that adjusted my wrist asked me if I wanted to continue with that doctor. And if I did, she wanted me to know that that doctor was out of network. And because the doctor was out of network with my insurance, I would be billed an additional $10,000 over and above the $5,000 deductible that I had to pay, plus the additional $6,000 because of the way that it's 20% up to, they pay 80%, and then I pay 20% up to an additional $6,000. So I was out of pocket $11,000, and then having to do another $10,000 was beyond my capability, so I asked them to stop. And I then wanted to get a doctor that was in network. And so the delay for my wrist was then, of course, it took longer for it to repair because bones grow back together. Anyway, basically, I was just wanting, and so it was just that I brought this up so that wouldn't happen to another person, that we wouldn't have to be paying so much. So my house was leaned, and I owed an additional $20,000 to these doctors. And then a year later, LifeWise sent a letter saying that they would no longer insure Legacy or OHSU because they were out of their network. So if you have a trauma, those are the two trauma hospitals that you can go to. So if you're in with LifeWise, then you are always out of network. So anyway, I'm starting to ramble. But that is basically my complaint.
And one of the things that came to light was the difference in the decision made at the time of treatment, whether something is emergency care or, is that the term, or trauma care. And that seems to be charged differently, and I'm not sure what the criteria is. And so this seemed to be a concern. So we are not intending to do any harm to hospitals, doctors, insurance companies. We try to call out a situation that seems to be a problem. Seems to need, it needs some work, and that's why we're bringing it before you. We intend to do some further work among ourselves and bring it back with hopefully some solutions.
It's the balance billing that people are doing.
Elise, you want to tell us?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Greenlick, and members of the committee. Elise Brown here representing LifeWise Health Plan, and for my first debut in the committee since session started, this is an unhappy time to be here. What I did communicate to the bill sponsor, Representative Boone, is that she has our commitment, LifeWise's commitment, to sit down and work through this scenario. I'd feel terrible listening to our member, Ms. Bryant's ordeal with this whole situation. So I know there's a way that we can make this better, and we're committed to doing that, Chair Greenlick. So if you can give us some time to sit down and do that, we'll come back to you.
No, that's terrific. Thank you very much. We will give you
thank you very much.
All the time we can within our time frame is the one we have to.
We're happy to answer any questions if anyone has any.
Yeah. That's too horrible a story to ask questions about.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Patty, do you want to talk to us? Ms. Bill?
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Patty O'Sullivan. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Just very quickly, I too met with Representative Boone on this. It was kind of unclear exactly where the issues really lie, if it was a matter of what the coverage was, what the coverage paid, whether, you know, the cost billing came afterwards. I understand, and I haven't confirmed anything because there just hasn't been time, that after a while the hospital did forego the rest of the payment like they typically do when somebody has the inability to pay. But if they have the ability to pay, then that billing would make sense and they would pay the bill, and they choose their coverage, and afterwards there is a bill to pay. The two trauma centers, Trauma Level 1, are OHSU and Legacy, and they bill typically at cost in the commercial market for Medicaid, of course. And
at cost or at the magic billing?
My understanding, Representative Greenlick, is at cost to the insurance company, correct, that there's very few contracts, and I'm verifying all this very early, there's very few contracts that are specifically for trauma, because you don't know how many, they don't know how many they're going to get, they don't know what it looks like when they get it, what complications there are, somebody's severely, severely injured to have to go to a trauma hospital, so it's hard to determine ahead of time what you would bill somebody. So there's very few contracts, is my understanding, and we're all verifying this. I met with some of the other insurers this morning with Representative Boone, and we were all kind of like a little bit perplexed about this.
There is that mythical rack rate that hospitals tend to charge that has nothing to do whatsoever with cost.
My understanding in this case, Representative Greenlick, is they bill at cost. So, and as you know, a trauma hospital has to have 24 hours, 7 days a week, level of care and equipment in order to be categorized as a trauma level 1 hospital. So, yes, it's very expensive, but, you know, we're there to save lives, and I believe that we did that in this case. So, at this point, we're...
I speak for the committee. I can tell you how much we really appreciate that.
Thank you, sir. So at this point, we're opposed to the bill, but we're working with Representative Boone to see if there's anything we can work out.
Great.
Thank you very much.
We will close public hearing on House Bill 2181 and wait for future action on that. I'm opening up a work session on House Bill 2134, and the intention to move that bill on. Do we have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
She gets to do all the work here.
You want to do it?
I'll just stop her for hurt feelings and let you do it.
He's just going to sit there and sulk.
Yeah, I'm sulking. That's right.
I'm proud to do this one. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2134 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Did we actually amend already? 2134? It says as amended, but I don't think we...
No.
Have an amendment, do we?
Mr. Administrator?
Let me...
Can we amend it?
I don't think we've taken action.
Did we amend it last time? I didn't
remember an amendment. We either amended it or we didn't amend it.
I don't remember an amendment.
This is an existential question.
I thought we did. Let me confer real quick here. Make sure that's the case.
We'll stand at ease for a moment. As amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I just have one question, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
There's no fiscal attached to this, correct?
There is no fiscal.
I didn't see one on OLIS, so I'm just confirming that.
Yeah, okay. We have a no fiscal. Minimal. Fiscal.
Got it. Thank you.
Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. have a volunteer?
Representative Widener wants to.
Oh, sorry.
I'll carry it.
You can't carry it.
Representative Kenny Guyer will carry it. But thank you for your offer anyway.
I was just thinking.
I wanted to hear his floor speech.
You probably will.
Passes. I close the work session on House Bill 2134 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2101 and ask Ms. Mercer to join us. Do we have some other testimony? Will you try and describe what the bill is, sir?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
You should start talking when I do that.
House Bill 2101 consolidates provisions relating to the Oregon Health Licensing Agency's authority over certificates, permits, licensing, registration, and fees for those services. Makes other modifications to provisions relating to OHLA's boards and councils administered by the OHLA. Becomes operative January 1st, 2014, and declares an emergency effective on its passage.
Can you tell us what you're about here, ma'am?
Yes. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Holly Mercer. I'm the interim executive director for the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. We oversee 11 boards and 21 different professions, and each of those boards has separate statutes that govern those boards. This legislation tries to streamline that particular piece of licensing that we do for each of those 11 boards. So we are asking this committee to send this bill on through. We think it does a lot to streamline our agency, particularly on the licensing side. And I am here for any questions.
But it needs more information on the revenue. So it has to go.
Okay.
Instead of ways, it means it's got to go.
We're looking to see whether we have any paperwork that's going with it.
Mr. Chair, there are also some dash two amendments.
Dash two. Does that mean there may be some dash ones as well?
Yes.
I have some questions of Ms. Mercer.
Sure.
Let's start with that.
I have a question. One of the sentences here currently regulates 18 different health and related professions. You talked about 21.
Should be 21.
Okay.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Kenny Guyer. They're basically subgroups of each of the 11 boards.
Mm-hmm.
Cosmetology has a number of professions underneath them. And I certainly can address the dash one and dash two amendments if the chair so chooses. I'd be happy to do that.
Please.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, the amendments that came through late on Thursday and Friday have to do with a specific board, the hearing specialists. And we were trying to work with our stakeholders and allow audiologists who are licensed through a separate board to be supervisors for both trainees and for people who hold a temporary license until they're ready to test. So we wanted to open that up to audiologists so that dash one and dash two do that. What happened between dash one and dash two was that there is a distinction between a trainee and a person who holds a temporary license. A trainee has to have direct supervision, and a person who holds a temporary license can have indirect supervision. So we just needed to make that specific change in dash two.
Dash two include the dash one?
Correct. It just changed the wording on page four to include supervision over a temporary license, because there is a distinction between those two.
Why don't we ask the next? Why don't you hang in? Why don't we ask the next two people that have signed up? Is that Wally Erdman and Jenna Ingram? I think you have something to do with the dash twos, huh? Either of you.
Mr. Chair, Genoa Ingram representing the Oregon Academy of Audiology. The Dash 2 amendments were brought forward at our request, and again, excellent synopsis of our portion of the amendments is that they would just allow the audiologist to supervise a trainee or someone with a temporary license. I have shared the amendments and circulated them maybe late, but over the weekend with Wally and others, and so far we have heard no objection.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Wally Ordeman. I'm the contract lobbyist for the Oregon Hearing Society, which represents hearing aid dispensers from around the state. When I signed up as neutral, but we are fairly supportive of House Bill 2101 as well as the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments. fundamentally agree with the amendments, which allows the audiologists to supervise trainees as well as temporary licensees. However, since audiologists do not come under the regulatory authority of the Oregon Health Licensing Agency, we feel just a little bit of concern that if audiologists are, if there's some non-compliant behavior or some bad acts, that there is not the leverage to discipline audiologists. It needs to also be said that the Oregon Hearing Society is not questioning the credentials of audiologists, nor are they questioning the ability of audiologists to supervise trainees and temporary licensees. But we feel that it's would be helpful and necessary for the same degree of accountability for supervisors, whether they are hearing aid dispensers or audiologists, that same degree of accountability for anyone that is supervising hearing aid trainees or temporary licensees.
Does this bill make your concern worse, or is it a standing concern?
Chair Greenlee and members of the committee, I don't believe that this makes this worse. We are generally there. Let me say it this way. ORS 694.147 does actually tie into this a little bit, where it says that, in part, the Oregon Health Licensing Agency may impose a form of discipline against any person dealing in hearing aids, but it isn't specific to those that are supervising those trainees. I'm not sure if I had, was I, I'm sorry, sir, did I answer your question?
No, let me tell you where I'm trying to go. I think unless there's a problem with this bill, we can work it today. We have the ability to rescind the subsequent ways and means because there's no fiscal on it. I just want to find out whether you're sort of recommending before we do that, we do something else, or are you okay with it moving forward in this current form?
Chair Green, look, we are fine with this bill, and we are fine with the amendments. I believe that Holly will, given the opportunity, might be able to address my concerns.
Some other
and our concerns.
You have a comment?
Yes. Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, I think it would be incumbent upon our licensing agency to refer any discipline to the audiology board since they have jurisdiction over audiologists. But I think that we would do so, and I think all boards would like to make sure that there is direct supervision and competent supervision. So we do not have jurisdiction over audiologists, so we would have to refer that to their board. But I think it can be done, and I think this was an amendment that we worked on together, and I'm optimistic that it actually broadens our ability to have supervisors. So
then we just move audiologists into your agency.
No,
a different bill.
I think we fought that battle, I think. thank you, sir.
May I ask a question?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Holly, I'm wondering if you can just say in plain, simple terms what this bill does compared to what you're doing now. Mm-hmm. The word authorization comes up a lot.
Yes.
I know you're trying to align. Is it because you've been overseeing these 11 different boards and you're trying to standardize everything you're doing? Like, what will look different in the future than what it looks like now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Chair Greenlich and Representative Kenny Geyer. What is different is that we take many of the things that we do, license, fees, continuing education, we put them into the Oregon Health Licensing Statute in a consistent way. Then we refer out to the other statutes. Right now, it is very piecemeal about how the statutes come together with all the 11 boards. So this is our effort to start using some similar language, renewal times, where we can. And I think this is the piece that makes this agency more streamlined, is that if we can have some continuity in terms of the language and consistency. So I think we've tried to bring this bill forward in other sessions, and it didn't make it through, so we're trying it again. And we had a previous bill that kind of dealt with the investigation side. We're going to go back and work on that this summer. But this bill is more on the licensing side. And it does give the agency some common ground to deal with all of our boards.
Okay. Follow-up question?
Yep.
Have you had an opportunity to talk with the separate boards and get feedback to them? And how do they stand on this?
Yes. Chair Greenlich and Representative Kenny Geyer, all the boards have been in favor of this language. I think they see the benefit of consistency. At every board meeting we've had for the last several months, actually probably the last year, we've talked about this legislation, did not receive any pushback at all from our boards.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing. House Bill 2101. I thought I heard a request from one of the committee members that's been set aside that we wait a day to work the bill. I hear that's not the case. But I do want to say to you, I think I may have not heard Representative Conger ask for an extra day on a bill in an earlier session if I did. I want you all to feel very comfortable if you say, hey, there's something I want to check before we work the bill. Hold it off till next session. Unless we're against some really tight timeline, I'd be very happy to take that request. So I just want to make sure you all feel comfortable with asking for that. And if I did miss it, I apologize, because it's a completely reasonable request.
It turned out it was a good bill anyway, so
yeah, but
it worked
still,
out.
I mean, it's the right thing. Not hearing that request, I'll open a work session on House Bill 2101, and I think we have a scripted.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -2 amendments dated 2/15/13 on House Bill 2101.
I have a motion from Representative Kenny Geyer to move the -2 amendments to House Bill 2101. Is there any discussion of that? I do understand that includes the -1, so is that the problem?
Okay.
Is there any objection to that? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2101 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue.
On revenue?
What is wrong? It needs further analysis. That's what the revenue is.
If we wait, can we get the analysis? I mean, it seems a shame to put it into another committee if it just waits some more analysis.
That's what the Speaker would like.
That's what the Speaker wants to do. That's what we do. We have a motion for Representative Kenny Geyer to move House Bill 2101 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, with subsequent referral to Ways and Means rescinded, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue. Is there any discussion on that motion? Will you call the roll, please?
Representative Flynn?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlich?
Aye. The motion passes. House Bill 2101 is gone, but not forgotten. I'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2122. Can you tell us what that bill is about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2122 prohibits the transfer of 500 or more enrollees from one managed care organization to another managed care organization with which provider contracts if the provider's contract with the transferring organization is terminated for cause, and declares an emergency effective on its passage.
Do we have some somebody signed up to testify on this bill? We do indeed. We have Deborah Loy. Anybody in opposition to this bill?
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Deborah Loy. I'm the Executive Director of Government Programs for Capital Dental Care, a dental care organization contracted with the Oregon Health Plan. As your staffer has indicated, this particular bill was requested surrounding Senate Bill 201, which was passed in the 2011 session, which allowed the transfer under the Oregon Health Authority of 500 and more members from one managed care organization to another if the provider was no longer providing services or had terminated his or her contract under the previous managed care organization. The bill, however, is silent on when it is the managed care organization that terminates the provider for reasons of competency, quality of care, or fraud or other serious type matters. House Bill 2122 has been requested in order to clarify or speak to the silence in the Senate Bill 201 of it having an exemption if it is the managed care organization that has made that termination choice. In instances where a managed care organization terminates, at least I know from ours, we do not do so lightly. It's usually done for substantial reasons of failure to meet contract obligations or quality of care concerns. And if it is a plan that is doing the termination and obligated to do so under our contract, it seems a disservice to have the plan have to be fearful to suffer membership being transferred for reasons of doing the right thing. The intent of House Bill 2122 is to ensure quality of care and program requirements under the Oregon Health Plan. I'd be happy to answer questions.
I really just like to review the history of this for a moment. This came about because one of the health plans in the Portland metropolitan area got in a dispute with a large pediatric group and ended up with the large pediatric group moving from one, it was an MCO, from one MCO to another MCO. And the question is, what happened to the members of the first MCO? It was a big dispute. It went into sort of arbitration or mediation with the Oregon Health Authority. We finally worked out a Solomon-like compromise and cut the baby in half. And in this case, half a baby was a lot of lives that went in one way or another. We passed a bill specifically relating to that in the 2011 session. For full disclosure, I voted against that bill because I thought it was not an appropriate thing. But the situation that came up here is a dental care organization eliminated or essentially fired one of its providers for what they believed was cause, and the question then came, did that trigger this bill? And the proposal here would say if the termination was for cause, then it wouldn't trigger the principles in House Bill 20-something?
House Bill 2122?
Not this bill.
Oh. Senate Bill 201?
Yeah. Right. Senate Bill 201. There is at least one amendment being proposed. Have you seen the amendments?
Yes.
and they provide a contested hearing.
Yes.
And that's it. Do you have a problem with that amendment?
I don't, in the dash three amendment.
I'm looking at the dash three. I don't have dash ones or twos.
Okay, that's what I'm looking at, too, is the dash three. The changes that were made in lines one and two, it was not our intent in requesting this bill to have Senate Bill 201's intent changed other than for the reasons specified in this bill. So our position on that part of the amendment is unclear due to that. Sections, lines 3 and 4, we would be okay with that language. And as far as the
lines 3 and 4?
Yeah, sorry. 3 and 4, we would be okay. And lines 5 through 7, we would support a provider appeal process. However, rather than narrowly leading to ORS Chapter 183, we would suggest that the Oregon Health Authority's current processes for provider appeals be used, whatever those might be, rather than creating something different for them. And that also that because these this would really only kick in for reasons of substantial cause, that that there would be some expeditedness or sensitivity to timeliness, because ultimately we're wanting to make sure the members have quality of care, and we would not want to delay those decisions.
Would you work, please, with the committee administrator to get an amendment that suits your needs and let us have them as competing amendments so we
can
see what's going on? Yes, sir.
Sure. The purpose of that amendment was to put in place some kind of an appeals process so that, I mean, we're in a lot of turmoil right now in what we're going to do about health care transformation, in case nobody noticed. And this puts a position in the eventuality that a large healthcare organization comes in and stomps all over a particular physician way out in rural Oregon that they don't want to deal with anymore because they're a paperwork pain in the neck. They just say that the quality of care is inadequate. That's dismissal for cause. This says, in the event something like that happens, there is an appeal process so that that person can hold it. Wait a minute, Jack. I want to have some discussion about what you're calling cause. I don't know a good way to put dismissal for cause and those kinds of language in there and have it be other than translatable unless you have some kind of an appeals process open. What's in there may not be the best route, but a large contractor working with a single practice somewhere is not exactly a level playing field when they hold all the cards.
But that may not, in the first line, the something repeals the whole version.
Well, I'm telling you what the intent of the amendment is. To have some way for a practitioner or small clinic or whatever to be able to say, hey, wait a minute, we need to talk about this. Your reason for cause is not valid or is something else.
Could you coordinate work with them and see if we get an amendment that would suit everybody?
It's actually a dental group that brought the amendment in, so,
Well, I mean, I think the interesting thing about the amendment is that adding not after May eliminates the whole program.
Yeah, but that was the only intent, was to make sure, because we're dealing with contractors, a provider, and OHA, making sure we have a level playing field where people can feel, if they enter into one of these contracts, they've got somebody to adjudicate it if it doesn't go well.
Okay, will that work for you?
Yes.
Yeah. Good. And I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2122 and ask if there's any other business to come before the committee. We are very efficient. We have these long agendas and we get them done Early this
I would like to ask, can we be efficient like this on Fridays? Mondays, not so much.
That's right. No. Fridays.
Well,
here, here.
Yeah, let's drag it out on Monday and Wednesdays.
I got to redo it.
What do we have on the current program? I've been told that the three dental bills that are on the current Friday agenda have been eliminated as being unnecessary.
That was the tenor of a discussion I had with the...
They solve a problem that is no longer a problem.
Yeah.
What else do we have on Friday's agenda?
Well, we threaten legislation and...
Oh, I really do want to hear Dr. Goldberg's presentation.
Oh, yeah.
Let's meet Friday, and we will be out.
What am I looking for?
That's not anything else in the agenda.
Okay. You just want to leave with the two, and then
I was only joking.
So we just have these two.
No, but I think it's I mean, there's no point canceling Friday since we have a full agenda.
Yeah, right.
But, yeah, let's make Friday a short session. Finally getting out of Friday.
The word is going to spread.
We may be sorry someday.
But we won't add these.
Don't change the agenda.
For solutions. Proverbial solution. It's all on tape.
It is hard to the beginning.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Solution.
We are adjourned.
Thank you.